And we are recording. Well, you'll see on your study guide there, if you're wondering what that picture is on the very front, that is Hebrew for the covenant name of God, Yahweh. We'll be talking about that some this morning. Also, on the next page, you'll see a picture of a wonderfully clad fellow, and that is Gregory of Nazianzus, 4th century theologian, one of the Cappadocian fathers, and we're going to talk about them in just a moment as well. So those are your two pictures. I wanted to answer those before we went on so that you wouldn't keep wondering, now, is this Jesus? Did Todd put a picture of Jesus in here? No, that is a man named Gregory. Well, if you have a Bible with you, I want us to look at Exodus chapter 3. Exodus chapter 3. And we'll just pick up in verse 1 of Exodus chapter 3. And this is what it says. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, But I will be with you, and this shall be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Then Moses said to God, If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, Say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, Say this to the people of Israel, The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. That is an extraordinary moment in redemptive history. God is sending Moses forward to accomplish, to be his tool or his means to accomplish the greatest act of divine, gracious deliverance that will be performed until we get to the cross of Christ. The deliverance of the people out of Egypt will become the paradigm for God's gracious and glorious deliverance of his people out of oppression, out of slavery, out of captivity. It will be the paradigm that is used throughout Scripture to understand God's gracious deliverance up until we get to the cross itself. And you'll see references to this mighty and gracious deliverance. You'll see references to that throughout the Psalms, for instance. It was the supreme way to describe God's might, God's power, and God's grace. Now, we see here in verse 11 that Moses has a dilemma. And the dilemma is this: how am I going to stand before the most powerful man in the world, a man whose own people see him as a god? How am I going to stand before that man and tell him to release all of the Hebrew slaves, the thousands upon thousands of Hebrew slaves, all of that labor force? How am I going to stand before this most powerful man on earth and give him orders? And we see there what God says to him in verse 12, I will be with you. Now, let's just try to wrap our minds around what God is telling Moses to do, to try to understand how absurd that must have sounded to Moses. You want me to go before Pharaoh, the man viewed as a god on earth, the man whose people claim has the power to raise people to life and to take life by his own miraculous power. You want me to stand before him and tell him what to do with his slaves? But I tell you what, Lord, before we get into just how crazy that sounds to me, I've got another question. Because before I do that, I'm going to have to go to my own people. I'm going to have to go to the Hebrews themselves and explain to them what is going on. And they're going to wonder who I am, because I've been gone for 40 years. I've been on the backside of the mountain working for my father-in-law as a shepherd in complete anonymity for 40 years. And so before Moses goes to Pharaoh and does the unthinkable, he's going to have to go before his own people who do not know him, who almost certainly will not trust him. He's got to go before them and convince them that him going before Pharaoh and commanding Pharaoh, that's a good idea. And so he asks God in verse 13, who am I going to say has sent me? Because not only will Pharaoh not be swayed by or threatened by me, but my own people, they almost certainly are going to be opposed to my doing this. Because in their minds, you have to understand, in their minds, for Moses to go before them and say, hey, listen, I'm going to get you all out of this. You've been in slavery for 400 years. Let me fix this. You know, the last thing he fixed, he murdered an Egyptian and had to flee and has been gone for 40 years. But he's back, and now he's really going to fix it, right? And you have to, you know, put yourself in the place of the Hebrew people. They've been in this situation for 400 years. They don't conceive of any realistic prospect of getting out of it. And now this guy who's been gone for 40 years is going to plan to go before the man who holds their lives in his hands and say, oh, you have to let him go or I'm going to be really upset with you. Now, in their minds, they're thinking, you're just going to make things worse for us. We know what this man is like. He's vindictive. He's power hungry. He sees us as less than human. Moses, why don't you keep your mouth shut? And Moses is smart enough to know that they're not going to like this idea. So Moses says, listen, in order to validate this whole idea, I have to tell them that it's you who's sending me, but I need to know who you are exactly. I need a name. I need a name. How can I authenticate this mission that you're calling me to do? And God here is good, and he is patient. And look what he says beginning in verse 14 again. God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people, I am has sent me to you. Go also. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever. You know, it's crucial here, I think, to see that God gives to Moses two names. There are two names that God gives to Moses that sets him apart from the gods of the Egyptians. How is this God who is depicted in these two names, how is he so unlike the god of the Egyptians or the gods that they will encounter, for instance, as they travel towards the land of the Canaanites, the land that God is going to give to them? They're going to encounter all kinds of gods, all kinds of myths, all kinds of strange and in many cases violent and immoral worship practices. But this God is entirely different from them, and the differences in him are revealed in a mysterious fashion, but they are being unveiled in these two different names that God places upon himself and then communicates to Moses. And what God is going to tell Moses in these two names sets the stage not only for God, not only for knowing God and knowing that he is a deep mystery entirely unlike us, but also in knowing God who moves to us and who saves us. And so we even have here in this moment of God naming himself to Moses there at the burning bush, we have here in it the seeds of gospel, the seeds that will open us and open our understanding to how it is that God is moving towards his people. All right? So the first name, I am who I am. I am who I am. Now that is a strange name, isn't it? In fact, it's so strange that some rabbis and some Jewish scholars believed that it was something of a divine stiff arm to the people, or a slap in their face, that God is somehow mocking Moses' request to tell him my name. They believe that it's like God is saying, who are you to ask me my name? You want a name? Here it is. I am, you know, it almost sounds like Popeye. I am what I am. And it's this divine stiff arm. But that is not what is happening. What is being said here, technically, this name or this word that God gives to Moses is the Hebrew to be verb, A-A, Asher, A-A, Yahweh, the Hebrew to be verb. It can actually be understood in three different ways. It can be understood as, I will be who I have been, I will be who I will be, or I am who I am. And so it could be past, present, or future tense here, this Hebrew to be verb. And the vast majority, almost exclusively, of translations of the Torah render it as I am who I am. But I actually don't think that makes all that much difference. Because I think what matters here about the name remains the same regardless of what tense it's placed in. So follow along with me in this line of reasoning here. When we talk about someone, we do so in reference, typically, we do so in reference to other people. When we get to know someone, typically, that knowledge of the person begins with understanding them and noticing them in relationship to and in contrast with other people. So let's say we're in a crowded room with lots and lots of people in it. And my wife and I are there, and Karen's over on one end talking to a group of people. I'm over in another and talking to a group of people, and someone comes up and meets me, and I introduce myself, and I say, my wife is Karen. She's over there. And then I begin to describe her. You know, she's, you know, 5'10". She's my age but looks younger than me. She has dark hair. She's standing by that lady over by the green sofa. She's the one that's slightly taller than that lady. They have similar color dresses on, but my wife's hair is shorter. And that's what I'm doing. I'm comparing her to other things and other people around her in order that this person can begin to understand who she is. And that is typically how we start to know people, by this kind of intricate web of comparisons and contrasts. And that is precisely what is shut down by the way in which God names himself to Moses. You see that? Because when it comes time for God to reveal himself in ways that are unique, up to this moment in redemptive history, what does he do? He says, you cannot compare me to anything else. I'm not like anything else. He doesn't say, well, you know, I'm like Pharaoh, but I'm more powerful than him. He doesn't say, I'm more loving than your mother, or I'm wiser than your best teachers. What does God say? I am who I am. And in that way, he shows himself as being unique from the rest of his creation. He can't be compared. He is quite literally incomparable. And this is why we've already said this, already in the first two sessions of this class, that God is in a class by himself. Do you remember taking biology in high school and you know, the tables in biology, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. Yeah. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. And we would want to say that, you know, God is not of the same species as us. He's a different genus. He's a different phylum. He's a different kingdom than us. He's in a class by himself. Augustine says that this name, I am who I am, is a great mystery. And it is. It sets us back. It leaves us wondering, God, who are you? Well, I am who I am. Can you imagine how frustrating that would be if somebody told you that? Hi, I'm John. Hi, I am who I am. I mean, I need to find a different conversation partner, and quickly, because this is very strange. At the very first, this tells us that God is other, that he's holy, that he's separate from us. What has he just told Moses to do? Take your sandals off, because you're standing on ground that is holy, not because the soil itself is different in composition, but because I am here, Moses. I am the Holy One, and I make whatever I touch holy. And this name is reflective of that holiness. Holiness meaning literally set apart, other. But there again, we see that God gives Moses a second name. So I am who I am. I am this one who is mysterious, who is beyond you, who is holy, who is not easily comprehended by you. But then he gives him a second name. God, and we see it there in verse 15. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all the generations. Now, this is a very different sort of name, isn't it? This second name, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now, we oftentimes refer to those three men as the patriarchs. God establishing his covenant of grace with Abraham, where there is this announcement that salvation will be by grace through faith, looking forward to a sacrifice that God himself will supply. He makes that covenant of grace with Abraham, and he says that this promise is for you and your sons. Isaac comes along, the covenant continues, then Jacob. Those three men, father, son, and grandson, those are the three patriarchs of redemptive history, God's dealings with mankind. And if the first name points to God's holiness, I am who I am, if that points to his otherness, his transcendence over us, then it's this second name that indicates what? His nearness, right? He's locating something about himself in their own family tree. In the second name, God connects himself to those three historical figures, three men whose place in Israel's history cannot be overestimated. Now, today you ask the average person on the street, who's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you're likely to get vacant stares. You ask the average evangelical who Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are, and they may not be able to tell you either. But to Moses, these names meant something incredibly significant. In a sense, God is saying, with this second name, he is saying, you can know me because I am connected to your family. I go all the way back to the fathers of your people. Fathers of your people knew me. Your fathers knew me. That's the sort of proximity, the sort of nearness that is being described here. I preached my dad's funeral 2 years ago, August, this past August. And while I was there, I met a cousin of my dad. She's brilliant. She's a scholar. And for years, she had been working on a very detailed genealogy for their family. And it's she's had it published. It's been verified through various sources. She spent most of her years doing the research in New York. And it's fascinating if you're a part of my family. It's not fascinating if you're not a part of my family. But what caught my interest when she first had the results published about 7 or 8 years ago, and my dad sent me the book and then other documents, was that she traces our family line all the way back to John Knox. And so I'm in a direct line to John Knox through one of his daughters. And so I come from, and incidentally, I come from a long line of Scottish Presbyterian ministers, which is good because by the time they got to the United States, they turned into Pentecostal holiness, folks. And they're an interesting bunch. But I at least have a line of Scottish Presbyterian ministers. And it was fun. When I was back in St. Louis to do my dad's funeral, we had a big meal, and this woman, this cousin of his that I'd never met, but I'd seen her research, was there. And she just sat with me, and we talked for probably 2 hours. And she was just a wealth of information about the history of Scotland and about the work that she had done tracing our family tree. Now, Karen and I had an opportunity just this July to go to Scotland. And we took a couple of day trips to Edinburgh. Saw St. Giles Cathedral, where John Knox preached and ministered up until the time that he died. I stood there in the parking lot and saw the parking lot, space 23, where under which John Knox is buried. And you know, what do you think, knowing, you know, what I had known and read, what do you think, you know, was going on in my heart and in my mind as I was there in Scotland? I mean, I was ready to put on a kilt, grab some bagpipes, and start preaching against the Queen and the Pope and all that kind of stuff. And it's because I have knowledge of this familial connection, which is made being there all the more moving. As I was standing in front of the statue of John Knox in St. Giles, you know, I was kind of explaining this to him and telling him how great I turned out and how happy he'd be that I rescued our family line from the Pentecostal holiness folks. So, but there was this automatic feeling of kinship, because I know, along with millions of other people, because it's been hundreds of years, who are related to John Knox. But as you think about this second name that God gives to Moses, he's inviting him to understand this familial connection. Moses, I am the God your fathers worship. I am the God of your family tree. And so while Augustine refers to the first name, I am who I am, as a mystery, he refers to this name as God's name of mercy. Isn't that good? God's name of mercy, because what is God proclaiming in this name? I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's saying, Moses, I'm the God who makes the covenant of grace. I'm the God of your people. In book one of his Confessions, Augustine says that God is nearer to us than we are to ourselves. God's holiness, his otherness, does not mean that he remains distant from us. Now follow along here. Because of God's holy distance, and I want you to make a connection here, because of God's holy distance from us, because he is so other from us, he is also able to be closer to us than anyone. Now hang with me on this. Seems contradictory, seems strange. Because of God's otherness, he is able to be so close. Think about your closest relationships. When I say, what are your closest relationships? You're going to think about your spouse, your children, your parents, longtime friends. And isn't it true that those closest relationships are, because of their closeness, also some of the most challenging in some ways? I wish I could understand my son. I wish I could understand my wife when she says such and such. I wish I could figure out why, you know, my best friend's personality when he does this and that. Even our closest relationships, there are limits to the kinds of closeness we experience.